Let's be honest. How much art have you scrolled past on social media that just feels empty? Like it was created less out of passion and more to keep the wheels of capitalism turning. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying the technique is bad or that anyone could do it. What I'm talking about is that kind of art that at first glance seems profound, but the more you sit with it, the more you realize there's not much happening under the surface. Here's the thing. I don't think that any artist sets out to make art like this. If anything, they're usually the victim of the system itself. The system that whispers into their ear, make what sells. The system that pushes them to prioritize collectors' taste, Instagram likes, and whatever the zeitgeist happens to be craving at that time, over their own artistic desires. And honestly, can you blame them? If the choice is either make what you want but starve or compromise a little and keep the lights on, you can see why most people bend. This is what makes artists who don't bend so rare. The ones who stick with their own vision, even when the world isn't paying attention. The ones who eat, sleep, and breathe art, and somehow, against all odds, refuse to let their hearts get pulled off course. That type of artist is Eddie. I'm your host, Jacob Johnson, and this is the My Art is Real podcast, a narrative journey into the lives that shape art. Today's episode, episode 61, Eddie Stevens, right after the break. Before we get back to Eddie's story, I want to share something special. If you're listening to this episode as it came out, you're in luck because Eddie has a brand new solo exhibition opening soon. From September 12th through October 19th, you can see his work on view at VCRB Gallery in Antwerp. It's a rare chance to experience his paintings in person, and honestly, if you've only ever seen them online, I promise you, seeing any works in person, it's unreal. It's a completely different experience. And alongside this show, Eddie is also releasing a brand new art book called Dressings. It will be available to purchase at the start of the exhibition, and will probably be delivered around the end of October. So if you've been moved by his story today, this is the perfect way to connect with his work directly through the gallery or through the book. All right, enjoy the episode.
Okay, hi. My name is Eddie Stevens. I'm from Antwerp, Belgium, and I'm an artist. I'm a painter. I was born in Antwerp, so I stayed there until I was about 26, I suppose. And then I lived for about 10 years to France. We lived for about 10 years in France. And then we came back to Belgium about 12 years ago. But now I live in other part of Belgium, in the French-speaking part of Belgium.
City kid then? Or were you more of like a suburbs kid?
Yeah, it was more a suburban area. It took about 20 minutes to go to the city. So we lived in nature around the city. But it was close by to go to, I don't know, cinema and museums and bars and stuff like that. My youth was completely in those separate houses. And then you learn to know all the children that live in the neighborhood because you go to the same school, small schools. I think that's also the reason that all my friends are friends for about 55 years ago that I met in school, and we grew up together, and it's always together, that's a nice memory.
Eddie grew up with a tight-knit group of friends, the kind where you always had someone to hang out with, someone to get into a little trouble with. That community really shaped him.
There were a lot of woods, so we built camps or we construct stuff to race with our bike. We played on the streets, we played tennis and, stuff like that, and driving around to look at young girls and stupid things, normal things, I think, for a guy from 16 years old, something like that.
But even with all of this, there was something else that was pulling at him. It was drawing. From a young age, Eddie was sketching so much that his schoolwork started to take a back seat, and his family, well, they noticed. They knew even then how much this meant to him.
I was a very bad student in school already very young because I was always drawing stuff. So I think that was the first sign. And then my parents sent me, when I was about 7 years old, they sent me to a sort of creative studio in the village, something really small, because they noticed that I loved drawing and making stuff. And so I went there when I was seven. Eventually, the guy who ran it was an artist. He was a painter. So I think he must have been at that time about 30 years old. And so I went there every Saturday to, like, you know, make stuff in carton, masks and a car, and then use paint and all sort of creative things.
Medium didn't matter. Pencil, paper, napkins in the dining hall. It was all just a way for him to bring his ideas to life. And pretty soon, his teacher was noticing as well.
And I suppose after a while, he noticed that I had some talent to maybe do more than that. So he proposed start making small paintings and small drawings. And then in the future, we would do a sort of exhibition. But, you know, Jacob, all in very small sizes, in a very small village, and nothing special. So my first exposition I did when I was 16. So at that moment, I already knew, I think I must have been 12 or 14 years old. I realized I wanted to be a painter.
For most of us, it can take years, sometimes decades, to figure out what we're supposed to do with our lives. But Eddie, he knew early. And once he knew, that was it. This was the thing, the dream. And he was going to fight to hold on to it no matter what. Do you remember how it felt in those first moments of painting as a kid where you realize, oh, this is it. This is the thing that matters most to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Because and I started when I was young, I started with acrylic paintings. So it's on a water basis. And I did that because the guy told me it was easier to learn to paint, you know, to use paint and make something of it. Because oil paint has a sort of extra, I mean, maybe more difficult technique than acrylics. For me, like, I could express myself by making an image, and maybe even at the time, because I was, sometimes I was bullied at school because I was pretty fat. It's not a polite word. So, and I could use that painting to maybe solve those issues. That's the way it started. And I could paint a naked woman with a shark face, and nobody could say, like, you cannot do that, except for my mother. She was a little bit worried, but she always said, oh yes, that's very special. That's very special. She also, I mean, she only wanted to be nice. It must have been, I suppose, weird to see your son, like, expressing himself in that bizarre, surrealistic way when he was young, but has been a sort of natural stuff that happens.
For Eddie, it all started out as an outlet, a way to work through the noise in his head, the struggles of growing up. Inside this world, his world, there were no rules. Whatever he could dream, he could paint, and no one could tell him otherwise. I know today that you're known for your very figurative, surrealistic style. But even back then, were your drawings always that surreal?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was not liked a lot the last 30 years. The last 10 years, it came much more appreciated, I suppose. We have Magritte in Delvaux, the Belgian surrealist. They were for me the biggest example of what I wanted, the way that I wanted to go. Or like Salvador Dali, I had a big poster in my room at home. So I was very young, already drawn to that style of painting.
As Eddie got older, art stayed at the center. But school, not so much. His grades slipped, and eventually they slipped so far that he had to drop out.
If you're 16, you can imagine a little bit where it is in school time. It's not a lot, you know. And I did it 2 times in a row the same year because I didn't succeed. My points weren't good enough. And already the people, my teachers in school, realized what I was doing. They realized that I was a good drawer and painter. So they begged me to, like, my French and my mathematics and my history and stuff like that, that to do an effort, because they couldn't let me go to the next year, which was the year before you can go to the real art academy. You have to be at a certain level to get accepted to go there to the big art school studio where you become an artist. But I didn't have the energy to do that. I was always distracted when I had to study, or was distracted and I started to draw and I was not interested and bored. So yeah, eventually for the third time, bad results. And then my parents said, okay, Eddie, we cannot keep doing this, you know. And in school they also were a little bit upset because they said, we know you would be a good art student in the future, so it's sad that it's not going to happen. And I was really sad myself, you know. I was crying to get away with my teachers, like, oh, I cannot go on.
It wasn't for lack of trying, though. He wanted to do well, but the way school worked, the way you were supposed to learn, it just didn't click for him. And Eddie doesn't see that entirely as a bad thing.
I'm going to tell you this now, because otherwise maybe I forget. The advantage that I had of not going to art school is that I've been not being, because that was really typical at that time, being pushed to certain movements and styles by the teachers. And that were stories that we heard a lot at that time. Oh, if you have that teacher, you're going to have to do this and that, because otherwise you will not like it. You will never be able to make figurative art because it's not popular at that time. And the advantage that I had of not going to art school is that I always kept doing the same thing. And I think that's the advantage that I have now for the last 20 years, that I'm in that style of work. I had a lot of progress, I think.
All Eddie cared about was being an artist. That was the plan, or rather, the only plan. But when you're 16, out of school, and your parents are looking at you like, okay, what now? You kind of need a backup. You need something that's going to make money immediately. And for Eddie, that backup was his dad's trade. His dad trained him to become a diamond cutter.
My father was a diamond cutter in Antwerp, and it's been in the family all the time. All the brothers were, and their parents were, all in diamond business. Not in buying and selling diamonds, because we were not the rich part of the diamond industry. But they want to give me a sort of certainty for the future, and they said, okay, go with your dad, learn to cut diamonds. If so, in the future, it should not work with your artist stuff, then you can go back to that, because then you have a profession. So that's what I did for about 5-6 years.
Now, if you hear Antwerp and diamonds, you might imagine wealth, big money, velvet-lined showrooms. But Eddie's family wasn't in the business of selling diamonds, they were just cutting them. And while that made for a decent living, it was far from glamorous. And for Eddie, it was torture. Every minute at the workbench felt like an eternity, a minute stolen away from painting.
After I was 16, I went working with my dad. Every day was a day that every minute felt like hours, you know, because I was like just waiting and waiting to start my life like I was imagining it. So that were tough years for me, because it's such an urge, and you know that it's your thing. And not that I was sure that was going to be able to financially survive or something like that, but just I needed to do that to be happy. I knew that would be the only thing to be happy. I couldn't not imagine myself go somewhere, work for someone else, doing what they tell me that I have to do. And with all due respect, Jacob, but it was not my thing. I knew that if I want to be happy in life, I have to do that.
Then it was in his early 20s, something shifted. He found a mentor, not someone who taught him technique per se, but someone who showed him what it actually meant to live the life of an artist. And so how exactly did you meet her?
And then at a moment when I was about 21, 22 years old, I met a female artist, because she was the mother of a friend of mine, someone I met at the time. She opened up for me the complete world of having a studio and being there all day long, painting in silence. And I had a sort of the same surrealistic style of working like she had, but she was, 25 years older than I was. And she gave lessons in the weekend in an art school. So she told me, you can come every Saturday. I put you in a separate small room, not with the other students, and you do your stuff. And every once in a while, I come and check you. And if you do something wrong, I tell you, you have to do this and have to do that. And I did that for about 2 years and 2 or 3 years. I forgot. That woman that at a certain moment told me, you know, Eddie, you really have to go for it. You really have to do that because it's your thing.
Were you kind of looking for a mentor at the time or no?
No, I wasn't looking for someone because I like to be alone in my studio and teach myself stuff. And I know it takes a longer time, but I'd rather be alone in my studio because then otherwise I cannot concentrate myself on what I'm doing. But she was the mother of someone I've always been a big Italian car fan. And so I met a young guy at the moment. He drove with an Alfa Romeo Spider, and his mother drove with an Alfa Romeo Spider. So that's how I met her, because she drove, the artist, the woman, she drove also with the same car. And the first time I came in her studio, I forgot all the guys. I was only interested in her life and in her way of working. And there was a kind of energy in her studio that was so convincing for me that I needed a space like that to really get into it, you know. Having your own studio is a really important thing, because if I have visitors here, they always say the same thing if they come inside. like there is a sort of, I don't know, an energy or an atmosphere. I collect a lot of things also in my studio. And yeah, it gives a sort of separate world thing, you know?
And I get that. I'm the same way. I can't focus on anything I'm not passionate about. I've tried. I've worked jobs where the paycheck was steady, the hours predictable, and the whole time, it felt like my life force was being drained away. If you've ever felt that, that everyone else seems fine living what we're told is a normal life and you're the only one who can't hack it, you start to wonder, am I crazy? But here's what I've learned through this podcast. We're not crazy. We're just different. We don't fit into this mold we're handed, and that's okay. For Eddie, finding this mentor was proof that his life, the artist's life, was possible. That it was worth pursuing, that it wasn't madness.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I think that in a sort of way, we are more normal people because we have the possibility to be ourselves. And I think that's also one of the reasons that there is so much stress and anger going on in the world, because a lot of people are just like surviving, you know, go to work to earn money to live, but then you have to go back to work. You don't have the possibility to live your own life. I mean, maybe I'm a little bit too black and white now, because I suppose a lot of people like their work in office and they like to work together with a group of people and they like to work with figures and stuff like that. So for everyone it's different, but it's like you say, Jacob, if we want to feel, have a good life, we have to find it in our own way of making life, you know. I didn't start to paint to be able to sell them. That was not the first reason. First reason was indeed because I felt good about doing that. I felt sort of relieved and surprised by the things that happen when you're painting and the concentration you have and the good stuff that happens and the bad stuff that happens and the problems you have to solve every day.
Eddie didn't start painting to get recognized or for money or for a career path. He painted because it felt good. Because the process itself, the brush, the canvas, the stories was meaningful to him. And honestly, what better reason could there be? We spend so much of life trying to survive. If you're lucky enough to find something that brings you joy, and even luckier to still find a way to do it, there's nothing more rewarding. Eddie had that dream. What he didn't have yet was a solid plan. Tell me the plan. What exactly was the plan?
I didn't really have a plan, you know. I just knew for myself that would be the only way to be happy in life. So I was ready to take all the risk I could take. I lived alone at the time. The moment that I met my wife, I told her that I didn't want children, because children, with all due respect, Jacob, I realized that if we started with children, that maybe there was a day, that a day would come that I wouldn't earn enough money with the paintings, that I had to stop painting and go and work, do something else for a living. And I didn't want to do that. Luckily, my wife was not also like, she didn't have a children's dream. She is also someone creative and she has horses and stuff like that. Luckily, that fitted well between us. So I always only had to take care of myself. And that made it easier that the day that I had a bad show, well, okay, then I had a bad month and I had to be careful with the money, but I still could keep on painting. And I always had that urge to do it. So it's not because I had a bad show that I stopped painting. I'm doing it for myself. And eventually you have shows and galleries and everything. That's something that happened with the time, you know. My idea was, you want to be happy, then you have to become a painter.
So, the plan. There really wasn't one. Because here's the truth. We can't have everything in life. We make choices. We decide what matters most. For Eddie, art was the thing. But he still had to make money like the rest of us. Luckily, he had one skill tucked away from those years in his dad's workshop, diamond cutting. It wasn't glamorous, but it was steady, and it was a good start.
At a certain time, I got an offer to go to India for 6 months to build, together with someone else, to build a diamond factory for cutting diamonds. And because I did that for about 6 years, I knew how to do that. And so I went to India because I could earn a lot of money those 6 months. So that's what I did. I went for 6 months, which was a very, very interesting thing to do at that age, because in India at the time, it's about 40 years ago or 35 years ago. If you come from Europe and you stay there for 6 months, you realize what a lucky bastard you are. True, because you're young and you think everything is possible. And then, so that was a very good lesson in life. So, and it was also a sign for me, like, okay, go for it. The worst thing that can happen, because I didn't have children or something like that, the worst thing that can happen is that you, I don't know, you live in a very, very small studio, but if you can paint, that was the most important thing for me. But I knew that I did that to come back into, I start a professional career as a painter.
After India, though, things shifted. Back home, it was time to double down in the studio. And Eddie's smart. He knew he needed income, but he also knew he couldn't let the painting slip. He started picking up client jobs, work that would allow him to keep the paintbrush in his hand.
So I came back and I started to do that in a professional way. And in the beginning, I made it like a combination. In the morning, I did like children's rooms and I painted teddy bears and elephants and stuff like that, or like a swimming pool and you have Roman figures. I did that to be sure to have enough money to survive.
And then every afternoon, he carved out time just for himself, for his own work, for his own vision.
And then in the afternoon, I made my paintings because I always had I want to have the freedom to paint whatever I want to paint. I don't want to do it in a style that is popular, or because at the time, figurative paintings, it wasn't popular at all. At the time, you need to like invent new stuff, and then it has to be modern and new. So I never did that because I only felt good in doing what I was doing from being a small boy.
That discipline, that staying true to himself, not chasing trends, that's what carried him forward. Because back then, there wasn't Instagram. There was no online forums where you could upload paintings, cross your fingers, and wait for likes. If you wanted people to see your work, you had to take it out into the world. Galleries, pop-up shows, any place that would have you. And then you had to hope and hope again that the right person would walk in.
I've been always painting. In between all those stories, we've been always painting for myself. I start to have a small, very small gallery for the first time, a little bit of better gallery. Sometimes I rented a space to do something myself. Then at the moment, there was a gallery from Holland who was interested. And that's the way it builds your sort of artist world.
What I admire about Eddie is this. He never compromised his vision. Not for money, not for praise. That's not easy. He worked through years, decades, when surrealism was out of fashion, dismissed, and he just kept painting. Eventually, the tide shifted. One show led to another, then another, and slowly a network of galleries and collectors formed around him. It didn't happen overnight. It took more than 10 years, countless hours in the studio, and sacrifices, big and small. But piece by piece, Eddie built the life he had always wanted. Do you remember when exactly you were finally able to make a living just off your paintings?
I think I must have been like 30, something like that. Yeah, then I really could stop doing that and live from my paintings, because at that time I already had about 4 galleries I worked with together, so I could make a sort of rotation with my shows, that every time there is somewhere, there is a show and there are paintings, there is money coming in, you know.
And how did it feel when you realized, okay, I've actually done this, this is my life now?
Well, it felt good, but I must admit that every show, every time again, you're scared that you will not sell the paintings, and it will be a bad show and you will not have the money. So that is something that took many, many, many years before you have a sort of reserve to be sure that a bad show is okay. And of course, now, touch wood, it's not happening a lot to have bad shows, you know, and the prices are getting higher every year. It's less stressful than at the time.
When you have all these shows and all these things to think about, how is it that you keep the stress from getting to you and keep the stress out of the studio?
My wife helps me a lot with that. She is a very realistic thinking person. She does all the paperwork, all my paperwork, everything that has to be done with the galleries, with the selling prices and everything. Luckily, I have someone like that, because I would be a very bad person to like organize that in a proper way, because it's not always easy to work with galleries. They're not always correct to the artists, but okay, it's a part of the job, you know. But you know, it also evolved in a natural way. The fact that I started really young working with galleries makes it much easier to like understand how they work and know what is important for you and what is not important for you. So you can like tell them, okay, we're going to do it. You want to do it this way and that way, but you have to take care that this and that will happen. And like, it's just the fact of doing that such a long time that I now know a little bit what to do and what not to do, and to tell them what's important for me and to tell them also what I don't like to do, you know?
Over time, the shows multiplied. The collectors came, the fans, and life began to feel stable and even comfortable, until things started to not feel so comfortable. Hey, while we're here talking, let's talk about supporting artists. There's another way you can get involved. Head on over to myartisrael.com. We have a series of limited edition art prints. Each print is created in collaboration with past guests from this podcast and other artist friends of mine. They're collectible, they're limited, they're beautifully made, and most importantly, they directly support both the artist and this show. So if you want to bring a little piece of this creative world into your own home and help us keep these conversations going, head on over to myartisrael.com and check out the prints. All right, back to the episode. You mentioned earlier that you moved to France for about 10 years. What led to that move? And had you always been drawn to travel or anything?
Of course, I was a normal traveler because I wanted to be home a lot, because I wanted to paint, so I couldn't travel a lot. But the reason I went from Belgium and live in France is because I was disturbed. At that time, I lived in Antwerp City. So in the village, and I was disturbed a lot. I became a little bit more famous, Jacob. So a lot of people start to know where my studio was, and they came a lot uninvited and stuff like that. So I found it at that time really disturbing a little bit. Started to be annoyed by people sometimes. At that time, 9/11 happened, and I realized I was painting when I heard it on the radio, put on the news, and it was happening live, you know. I really thought, like, the world is fucked up, you know. Sophie, my wife, came home. I told her, you know, I want to be farther away of all that. I didn't feel good anymore. I was too much busy with other stuff. And so that's why we bought a old farm in southwest of France. And there we rebuilt the farm. And we stayed there for about 11 years.
Leaving the city for nature, it was a shift. And while nature is beautiful, grounding, and restorative, it's not exactly the best place to observe the absurd. For that, you need the chaos of a city life.
Completely far away in nature, lost of everything, what's happening in the world. But eventually, I realized I was too young to be separated of what was happening in the world, because I realized that I was painting about what was happening with myself in the beginning, of course, but eventually also of the world. So I realized I almost got like depressed, because I lost all my influences that I apparently needed to realize what I was doing. Of course, in the beginning, when I met my wife, I made a lot of paintings of her, about 200, I think. So it was a mixture between paintings of my muse and the world around us and stuff like that. But after 200 paintings, I realized that the story was too blocked, too closed. So we sold the house in France. We came back to Belgium.
Eventually, he needed to return. He needed to bring some of that chaos, the absurdity, back. When he returned, he struck that balance. Time in the city, time in nature, both feeding him in different ways. And you can see it in the work. The influence of nature is undeniable.
That's something I remember. I always feel very responsible if I have an animal. Almost more responsible to take care of it than human beings in my daily life with human beings. My friends know that I'm not someone who calls them every week on the phone to ask how they are, but they know that it's that way. So, animals have always been really important. I told you that I made a small painting studio in the garage of my parents. I have a brother who is 2 years older than me, and he was always fascinated. He studied biology and stuff like that. And he always was, at the time that it was legal, fascinated by snakes and lizards and frogs and all the spiders and all the stuff. So he kept them in sort of big, it's not an aquarium, it's a terrarium. Yeah, terrarium. So he made very big ones. And he also different animals together, and they start to make babies and stuff like that. So it was in really good conditions that he did it. But it was in the same garage that I made my painting. So maybe it had a sort of influence on my subjects because I paint bizarre stuff. No, I don't know. But so he also had a sort of weird interest. And so I lived with such many different animals. We eventually, with my wife, we had Danish dogs, and they always have, all the dogs have been in the studio. When I'm painting, there is always a dog somewhere in the studio.
One thing I noticed you paint, a lot of birds. Where exactly does that come from? What do birds mean for you?
The birds, yeah, it has a special meaning for me because it represents for me freedom. Freedom of leaving, of flying out whenever you want. And I compare that a little bit with what I do with as a painter, you know. I have the freedom to do what I want. And I'm, yeah, I can like observe the birds in the garden when I take a pause when I'm working. I always had a nice feeling to have that kind of connection. And I don't know if you know there was a book and then they made a film of it and it's called Birdie. It's an old film, but it's about a guy that at a certain moment he sleeps in the volier of his birds and everything to like sort of connect, because he had a better connection with birds than with people because he had fought in Vietnam, I think it was. So it was a story that a sort of way I recognized myself in. So I also feel sometimes better with animals, because maybe they don't judge, or I don't have to explain them why I do something, you know, they accept everything. So I think that's a combination of reasons why you see them a lot in my paintings. That's also why sometimes I paint a person with a bird head, like it's something that is grown together, you know.
We all want freedom, but the truth, very few of us ever really get it. Even artists I know, people who should be free, end up tied down by contracts, commissions, expectations, and in the process, they lose the very thing that brought them to art in the first place, the freedom to explore. Eddie, though, he found it. He found that freedom. You know, obviously these works are personal to you, but do you feel any sort of sadness when they leave, or do you just feel happy that someone else has appreciated enough that they want to look at it every day, or how does it feel when a painting leaves?
Yeah. Now it's very easy for me because I made a sort of switch in my head. I also needed to have the freedom, and I also need the money to have the freedom and the opportunity to walk in my studio tomorrow morning and to paint whatever I want. So I had to make a sort of switch in my head when I was, I don't know, 16, 17, because at that time it was hurtful, because it's something very personal. At a certain moment, I went back to some people who bought small two paintings of me, some of the first paintings. And a few weeks later, I went back to their home and asked if I could buy them back, because I was really upset about it. Eventually, I didn't do that because they were very kind people. And then I realized, that's something you cannot keep on doing, you know? You have to make a choice in life. If you want to do this all your life, you have to sell them.
When somebody loves your painting so much that they want to hang it in their home, how does that make you feel? That's a special thing. Something that came out of your brain onto canvas is now something somebody else loves and adores.
Yeah, I couldn't say it better than you say it. It's unbelievable. And it still is. I am painting now for 45 years, and it still is so special that people decide to do that, because it is expensive eventually, you know. You know how the gallery work, how it works. You have commissions and stuff like that. So, and you have to pay taxes and everything. So art is expensive, and then I'm indeed always surprised that people pay for that, because it's canvas with oil paint on it. I mean, it's not a car where you have a lot of metal and stuff and electronics and computers and I don't know, mechanics and whatever. And it's such a simple thing. I like a drawing. I make drawings on paper with charcoal. There is nothing more simple than a piece of charcoal, you know. So it's so basic. So I'm always, every time again, surprised and very thankful that people buy it. And like you said, to to be confronted with it every day, because my paintings are not nice nature stuff, things like that. It's sometimes confronting to look at it, or it asks you questions when you pass by. It's so it's not so evidential. So no, I'm very, very grateful.
How does it feel now, looking back on your life and seeing that you were able to make your art career a reality? This is your life now.
It's a survival kit that I have received for life, I think. Or you can compare it by a sort of therapy. Maybe some people need a sort of therapy. They cannot find it in themselves, or in like that they make stuff or something like that. They have to go to someone to talk about it, to maybe learn to know yourself in a better way, learn to know what you want and how you are in life and how you react to people. And I think my life as a painter has made life much more easy for me to like survive the world. But I always realized that you can receive some talent when you're young, but you have to work hard to realize it, because it's an evolving thing, and you cannot sit back and say, okay, I'm gonna take a break of a few months because I don't feel like it. Or I when I was young, I knew a lot of painters that even if they didn't have the inspiration in the morning, they went to the bar and they start drinking, and you meet a lot of artists together, and they were like disappointed in the art world and everything because they didn't get recognition. But you have to show something, you know. If I see very young painters, you see that they are like searching to find their own personality in their paintings, which is very important, I think. If you try to really liked by a lot of people, if you follow those tricks, you will never get a personality. And it's the personality, I think, that makes you different than the others. And I think that's also what art lovers feel if they're in front of the collection of paintings that you have made. They feel it, I think, if it's real or not. If it has the sort of honest energy that you give. No left or right, picking some nice stuff to make your painting better. No reality. And sometimes reality is hard. And sometimes my paintings are pretty dark. Sometimes there are stuff that you can laugh about, strange combinations, but I don't do it to make it a strange painting. I do it because that's how I think and how I live. And as long as that you do it in an honest way, I think that's already a start to success, whatever that means. Yeah, because that's not the most important for me. It's happening now, after 40 years or 45 years of painting, but it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is to be able to do it every day in all the freedom that you have. That's the most important thing in success. I never have tried to look like an artist, because most of the time, if I met people when I was young, and they look like an artist, and you look at their work, they spend more time in being the artist than in making art. That's not the way that I saw the future.
Survival kit. I absolutely love that idea, because here's the thing. It's hard not to compare yourself. Hard not to look around and wonder why someone else is finding success and you're not. But at some point, you have to decide what matters more. Is it the number of collectors, the number of shows, or is it something else? Is it something more personal? Is it your ability to grow, to keep your freedom, to wake up and still feel like things you love belong to you? Eddie made sacrifices, big ones, to protect that, to keep his work real, to keep it his. And now, 4 decades later, he still walks into the studio every day knowing he did it on his own terms, that he stayed true, and in doing that, he found his freedom. Wow, this one hit pretty hard. Talking with Eddie, it gave me a lot of motivation, a lot of perspective of my own life. He's kind, he's generous, and honestly, it was an honor to have him on. I hope you got as much out of this conversation as I did. And just a reminder, this show is about keeping it real, and the reality is, I couldn't do this without you. Thank you for listening, for sharing this show, for showing up every time I upload. If you'd like to support the podcast and support our guests, you can check out the Miter's Reel limited edition prints on the website. Each print is created in collaboration with past guests and other artist friends. You can check them out at miterisreel.com. Thank you again for being here, and I'll see you in the next one.